Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
You think you're frustrated waiting for that refrigerator or desk or car to get delivered? Try being a purchasing manager. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday, October 5th. Good to have you with us. The Institute for Supply Management is where we're going to start today, because that word, supply, is one of the most pressing issues in the economy right now. ISM represents purchasing managers and other supply chain professionals and is out with two surveys tracking the movement of goods and services through the economic pipeline. Bottom line, businesses would be selling us a whole lot more stuff if they could, and that's weighing on the economic recovery. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has more.
If, like me, you have a household appliance that's broken right now, for my family it's the dishwasher, when you call for repairs, you may well hear something like this.
Due to coronavirus, demand for appliance repair has increased exponentially across the U.S. We apologize for the delays in service and excessive hold times this has caused.
Multiply this by basically the whole economy, and you get a lot of friction for sellers and buyers of everything from parts to finished goods. Chris Williamson is at IHS Market, which just reported a slowdown in manufacturing and services growth in September.
In supply chains, a lack of raw materials exacerbated by shipping constraints into US ports. But alongside this, firms are also reporting that they just can't get enough staff.
Let's see how this is playing out in one sector, autos. Jaron Smith is 39, lives in Vancouver, Washington. He and his wife have two kids, two dogs, and they've been in the market for a second set of wheels.
Yeah, a new SUV. I have been working remote, of course, since pandemic, but we'll be starting a new position in January that's going to require me to commute in, and that means we're going to need two cars.
Dealers tell him the wait on a new SUV will be several months. Chris Williamson says the problem for automakers starts with a shortage of computer chips.
If you can't get semiconductors to make as many cars as you want, you're going to be also buying fewer windshields, tires.
All that means less business for parts suppliers and higher prices for new and used vehicles, which hasn't deterred Jaron Smith from searching far and wide for a new Dodge Durango.
It's really hard to find one right now on a lot new.
So he's just ordered one for delivery. It'll set him back $62,000, and he'll get one add-on he really wants.
Ventilated seats. I've had them once. I don't ever want to go without them again.
He's expecting it to arrive sometime in late December or early January. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, all green. We'll have details when we do the numbers. While many were watching whistleblower Frances Haugen's testimony on the Hill today, pushing for more regulation of Facebook, Facebook itself was doing damage control on yesterday's widespread outage. In a blog post, the company said an error of its own making caused the nearly six-hour disruption when routine maintenance went awry. Here in the U.S., the temporary loss of Instagram and Facebook meant fewer memes shared, for sure, and may have cost the company millions in revenue. But we're going to talk about another Facebook-owned property that was also down, WhatsApp. Because in many parts of the world, it's not just another way to text, it's the way to communicate and even do business. And the outage for much of the planet was no joke. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has that story.
If you need kitchen supplies in Harare, Zimbabwe, Norlene Mkwemba is your woman. She's a public health student, but has a side business selling stuff like cups and juice bottles. She takes orders the night before school.
And then after school, I can deliver to people's offices.
Her customers reach her on WhatsApp and Facebook, and both were down exactly at peak ordering time.
So people couldn't pay their orders. So I lost about 5 customers, which is a lot for me.
WhatsApp is a lifeline for business in a way that websites and even phone lines are not.
Well, the internet is pretty slow in my city, right? So you find that websites are not exactly readily available and the data tariffs are really high. So people prefer buying WhatsApp bundles and Facebook bundles because they are cheaper and affordable.
WhatsApp is a major communication and business platform in a lot of emerging markets. Abraham Leno is in Kigali. He's head of the Eastern Congo Initiative. And he says WhatsApp has made communication more accessible.
Even the simplest phone, the cheapest phone, can allow you to connect with somebody anywhere in the world. And the data usage of the WhatsApp is way, way cheaper than many other platforms.
90% of 16 to 64-year-olds in Argentina, Colombia, and Brazil have it, according to Benjamin Gadan at the Wilson Center. The outage affected everything from group chats to business to even the news.
I mean, it was apocalyptic in Latin America. Every newspaper headline was screaming about this WhatsApp outage, and it seemed like it was bringing the entire economy to a stop.
He says a lot of emerging markets don't have competitive telecom sectors, so you get expensive texting, for example. With WhatsApp, texts are free.
It's been quite common in the development of telecom technologies that smartphones spread more quickly than the very expensive broadband infrastructure.
When you have a power outage, it affects neighborhoods, maybe regions sometimes. But we are now in a world where a WhatsApp outage affects whole areas of the planet. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
This week, a union representing about 60,000 behind-the-scenes film and television workers across North America voted to authorize a strike for the first time in the union's century-plus history. The International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees is negotiating with studios and streaming services over wages and working conditions. If they can't reach an agreement, productions could grind to a halt. It would be the first major walkout in the industry since World War II. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that story.
Production schedules in entertainment are generally pretty grueling for everyone, but particularly for the craftspeople and technicians who make up the IATSE union. They do the often unseen work, says USC cinema professor Jason Squire.
Their hours can be flexible, their days can be flexible. If a movie is behind, it's a bit of a juggle.
12 to 14-hour days, overnight shoots, Fridays that bleed into the weekend, what they call fratter days.
We go home and we sleep from like 6 a.m. to 3 p.m. or whatever on our Saturday. But then on Monday, we're back at like a 5 a.m. call.
Elizabeth is a script supervisor. We're using her middle name because she was concerned about retaliation. We caught her as she ducked into the bathroom between set changes, which she says is a pretty rare luxury.
They'll be like, we need you on set. They want to change a line or something. And I've had to yell out from the bathroom. I literally can't leave for like 2 minutes to pee.
The pandemic intensified these demands, says Marissa Shipley, an art department coordinator and vice president of IATSE Local 871.
In the shutdown, everyone turned to the arts and turned to all of this content that we help produce.
She says schedules have become even more frenzied as studios struggle to meet the surge in demand and make up for months of shutdowns. Shutdowns, she says, gave production staff a rare moment to breathe.
The extended period of rest last year changed people's perspective.
She says members are resisting the choice between having a healthy life and their jobs. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Burnout, who's with me? It's taken center stage in this pandemic, with remote work blurring the divide between home life and the office. And for those working in person, the pandemic has added a whole different level of stress. Some companies, Kickstarter and Unilever among them, are testing a four-day week to combat overworking and lift morale. Abigail Marks is a professor of the future of work at Newcastle University in the UK and wrote a piece for The Conversation recently about the strategy. I asked her how we got the whole 5-day, 40-hour work week in the first place.
In the US, people tend to talk about the origins associated with Henry Ford. People eventually move towards an 8-hour working day, 5-day working week. And in the UK, there is a sort of industrialist called Robert Owen, who said 8 hours work, 8 hours leisure, 8 hours rest.
It clearly has staying power, but it seems like a lot of companies and governments are starting to rethink it. Why is something like a 4-day week starting to catch on?
I think there is a realization that the work that people were undertaking in a factory and at the start of industrialization is very different to contemporary work, and that there's a lot of evidence that people are burning out, they're overstretched, they're overburdened. The actual intensity of work is much more than it was even 10, 15, 20 years ago, and that is having a detrimental effect on people's well-being.
But in your piece in The Conversation, you suggest that a 4-day week isn't necessarily the panacea some might want it to be. What are the shortcomings?
I think the intention of reducing working hours is a really, really worthy one, and I think it's right. I think the problem is employers are clearly going to try and force 5 days work into 4 days, which is going to make already exhausted people even more exhausted. I think it only works for particular groups of workers, some professional workers, but Uber drivers, people working in the gig economy, and people working in hospitality, it's not going to fly. So then I think it ends up being quite divisive and sort of separates the privileged from those that are in much more vulnerable positions.
Right. And you say, you know, if people are working more intensely during a shorter number of hours, that doesn't necessarily improve well-being.
Absolutely. And I think you really need to take a good, careful look at what we can do to reduce people's work intensity, whether that is reducing the volume of work, changing the way that people's productivity is defined. There's also, if we had a universal basic income, then it makes it much easier to reduce hours to the 4-day working week. But it's not so easy just to say 3-day weekend when we're in a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week society.
These ideas have just been highlighted by the pandemic, with so many workers feeling burned out and remaining extremely productive even while working remotely. How do you think this will change the way we think about structuring the workday as we move forward?
As you said, from the pandemic, we know home working did not decrease productivity. In fact, it increased it. But we also know it decreased people's well-being because of work intensification due to the complications of pandemic working. What worries me is that employers are then going to believe that hybrid working is going to equal productivity, but also not think about people's workload and what they're actually doing. And we're still going to have this really complex situation with increasing work intensification.
So if knocking a day off the work schedule doesn't work for everyone, what alternatives do you see?
I think we need to look at what people are doing, whether it is reasonable to expect people to work in the way that they're doing, considering life is structured in a very different way to the way it was at the early industrialized era. They need to look at working hours, because people aren't working 8-hour days. They're taking work home with them. They're looking at emails at 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night. So the 8-hour working day in some ways becomes a myth. So we really need to look at what we can do to support employees. If they are working an 8-hour day, to have really good breaks, to ensure that there aren't periods where they're feeling really, really stressed, to make sure that they're not taking work home with them.
Abigail Marks is a professor of the future of work at Newcastle University in England. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up.
Certainly one of the most economically segregated.
We'll tell you which city that is, but first, let's do the numbers. Market was back up today as tech stocks rebounded. The Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped 311 points, 0.9% to finish at 34,314. The Nasdaq found 178 points, 1.25% to end at 14,433. And the S&P 500 added 45 points, 1% to land at 4,345. Among the tech stocks rebounding, Facebook today, despite yesterday's big outage and that hearing in Congress with whistleblower Frances Haugen, Facebook scrolled up 2%, Twitter rose 2.5%. And in the auto lane, General Motors reports it's building a big electric vehicle battery lab in Michigan. GM revved up 0.6%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.53%. You're listening to Marketplace.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. We learned today from the Commerce Department that the U.S. trade deficit reached a new high of more than $73 billion in August, as a small increase in exports was offset by a much larger increase in what we imported from other countries, including China, with whom our trade gap grew by more than 10%. In China, some of the factories that produce its imports are grappling with a different challenge. In recent weeks, blackouts have affected millions of homes and businesses. More than 20 provinces are rationing energy. One city turned off the power so quickly it shut off safety equipment at a steel factory and sent 23 workers to the hospital with carbon monoxide poisoning. Our China correspondent Jennifer Pak has more on what life has been like for companies and workers trying to keep going.
Last Monday, Wenpeng was working the late shift at a parts factory in central China's Hunan province when the power cut off. It was just after midnight.
The machines stopped working, so the factory sent us home.
This just as the factory was getting busy. Manufacturers are using more energy this year, says Lin Boqiang, an energy policy professor at Xiamen University, because there are more overseas orders. And there's also increased demand, domestic and foreign, for metals like copper and aluminum.
Copper and aluminum prices are at their highest in years, so that's why manufacturers are also producing more.
At the same time, China is short on coal, which is used to generate most of the country's electricity. In theory, he says, these power shortages shouldn't be happening.
China has enough coal underground and enough capacity to generate electricity. It's just that we're curbing carbon emissions and not mining more coal this year.
It's not all about protecting the environment. China does import coal, usually from Australia. But relations between the two countries are tense. China's all but banned Australian coal, which has pushed coal prices up. And not just that.
In China, coal prices can increase, but not electricity prices.
The Chinese government wants to keep utility prices low, and power companies aren't allowed to pass on their extra costs to users, so there's no incentive to produce more electricity. The power cuts are creating uncertainty for folks like Fox Fu, who manages a software company.
The cuts began last Saturday. There were more on the Monday, and we were told the power would be off for the rest of the week. But on Tuesday, it came back.
As for worker Wenpeng, he hopes to return to the factory soon. Otherwise, he says his pay, like that of millions more Chinese, will be cut by a lot. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
Sometimes a small story tells a much bigger one. That's the case with this next piece from Austin, Texas, where the fight over plans to build a single affordable house in a wealthy neighborhood says a lot about why it's so hard to build affordable housing all over this country. And like a lot of cities, Austin really needs it. A population boom has pushed up home prices and pushed out low-income residents. Audrey McGlinchey with KUT takes it from here.
This story takes place in a wealthy neighborhood in West Austin. There are large single-family homes, nice lawns, and then there's this lot. The address is 3000 Funston Street. It's vacant, except for some lumber and overgrown bushes. It sticks out from the rest of the neighborhood, attracting attention. It's also attracted a legal battle. Nick Comiskey and his wife live down the street. She's in finance. He's a pastor. I asked him what he knew about this empty lot.
I knew that it was involved in a lawsuit and that the city owned the land and what could be built there was contested.
Comiskey is not involved in the lawsuit, but he summed up the case like this.
The city wanted to do something on it and that people that lived here did not want the city to do something on it.
The city of Austin has owned this lot for 5 decades. Since early 2020, it's been trying to build a 3-bedroom home here. The plan is to sell it to a low-income family for less than $300,000 in a neighborhood where homes go for $1 million. But before workers could finish the foundation, neighbors sued. They say building this home is illegal and potentially dangerous. A judge has ordered the city to stop construction. On its face, this is a story about one house. But in Austin and cities like it that have struggled to build affordable housing in rich neighborhoods, 3000 Funston is a site of a bigger question. How do you weigh the rights of neighbors to say what gets built next door?
Austin remains one of the most segregated, certainly one of the most economically segregated.
João Paulo Connolly works on housing issues for the Austin Justice Coalition, a racial justice organization. The area where some of the richest people live is home to just 5% of Austin's affordable housing stock. That's where 3000 Funston is located.
I think one of the issues is a question of space, right? A question of, you know, the distribution of who has access to resources and opportunities.
Austin's trying to fix this by building tens of thousands of homes for low-income families over the next 10 years and building them in areas with good schools and nice parks. That includes the neighborhood surrounding 3000 Funston. Trey Jackson is the lawyer for the neighbors. He also lives a couple doors down from 3000 Funston. He wouldn't agree to an interview, but in a brief email, he says this case has nothing to do with affordable housing. He says it's about two things. First, flooding. This part of Austin floods during heavy rains, and Jackson argues adding a house could make it worse. He also argues the lot is too small. And that second reason has to do with what are called deed restrictions or restrictive covenants. Elliot Shredder of the University of Calgary has researched restrictive covenants in Austin.
And oftentimes they're extremely specific.
These documents say what can or cannot be built on the land you own.
A deed can say, this is the minimum sale price. This is the maximum, this is the color.
The Funston lot where the city is trying to build is too small to meet the covenant requirement. It's about 1,000 square feet short. City officials wouldn't do an interview for this story. But in court, city lawyers argue Austin needs this affordable home. Since the lawsuit was filed, the city put the house out to bid again, and the price of construction has almost doubled. Remember that neighbor I talked to earlier, Nick Comiskey? I asked him what he thought about this whole thing.
It is laughably hypocritical for people that have kind of a progressive political ideology to be simultaneously very restrictive about their neighborhoods and the preciousness of their neighborhoods.
By September, the weeds at 3000 Funston were so high, it had started to look like an entirely different landscape. You couldn't even see the partial foundation. You'd think no one ever lived here, or ever would. We'll know for sure after the full case is heard this winter. In Austin, I'm Audrey McGlinchey for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out, which Kai flagged for me this morning. He's never far away, you know. The New York Public Library is doing away with fines for overdue books. Research shows fines don't work to get materials back on time, but they do keep people from using the library, especially those with low incomes and young people. The NYPL says 30% of the cards it's blocked for unpaid fines belong to patrons under 18. But hey, New York, Baltimore, and a lot of other cities did this years ago. Believe me, I've tested the policy. All right, we gotta go, but not without your moment of economic context. To finish up where we started with the supply chain, Best Buy is launching a new annual membership program, and CNBC reports one of the perks is access to hard-to-find items during the holiday season, though it did not say which items. Started your shopping yet? Our digital and on-demand team includes Siobhan Brett, Ufuk Memetolu, Janet Wynn, and Donna Tam. Sitara Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. I'm Amy Scott. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.